Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shab Marquitz. We are your hosts for the weekend edition, also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com. I also want to focus everybody in that website update that we launched early on this week. We're very excited to have a new and updated website. We're still working through some of the little nuances of the site, so please keep your emails coming. Let Shad and I know what you want to see in the website, any changes that you think would improve the site. We're really just trying to provide an updated platform and help really focus the message and organize the site a bit better in terms of all the different markets that we cover on really a daily basis. On this weekend show, we're going to be focusing a lot, again, on the precious metals, but also, as we always do, taking a big picture look at markets and some other key drivers that I think we all need to be at least cognizant of as we progress through the rest of this year, which Q4 continues to be quite volatile. We are kicking off the show with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. Now, Matt, we're going to start with the precious metals, more specifically gold and silver. We are recording this very late in the day on Wednesday. So we can, I guess, announce that Wednesday, very good day for the precious metals as gold moved up closer to $1,800. Silver moved back above $23. Now, look, this pop is encouraging for the precious metals investors, but again, $1,800 gold, we've been talking about that for months, and $23 silver, that's still near the bottom of the range for where silver is traded for about a year now. So, Matt, understanding that these precious metals were washed out along with the stocks even more so, is this bounce and this rally that we have seen over the last few trading days, do you think this is the start of another leg higher?
Well, Corey, firstly, thanks for having me back on the program. It's always good to join you. I don't want to be a wet blanket here, especially because I know you have a strong precious metal contingent amongst your listeners. But I would say most likely not. I do not think that this bounce today. Well, it has been nice to see gold up 2% plus and silver at times today up 3% plus. I think it's less likely than not that this is the start of a new leg higher. From my perspective, the market remains fully, firmly entrenched in a risk-on mindset. You're seeing folks within the mining space, you know, flock to metals like uranium. There's a lot of excitement there. But just generally, you have tech stocks still working. You have cryptos creeping back up towards the highs that we saw in spring of 2021. You have this NFT mania that maybe some of your listeners have started to hear about. At least in the United States, real estate prices are still moving higher. So I think across the spectrum, you know, the other portions of folks' portfolios are doing quite well. And I think we're unlikely to see that next move higher in precious metals until we firmly go into a risk-off environment. And it's hard to say when that could happen. It could be later this year. It could be early next year as folks take profits in a new tax year. And it could be in the spring of next year as folks realize that it's more likely than not that we'll have split government after the 2022 midterms. Or maybe this euphoric rally can continue for a bit longer than that. But I think sooner rather than later, we are going to see a shift from this risk on into a decidedly risk off mindset. And, you know, obviously in the immediate aftermath of that, there is the risk of, you know, a final capitulation event. So I think those of us holding precious metals and precious metal equities should be aware of that. You know, that said, from a 2 to 3 year perspective, I think it's a great time to be deploying and accumulating high quality names where, you know, the management, you know, the company stories, you know, their expected milestones, and you're confident that they're going to be able to deliver returns for you as a shareholder. You know, even if precious metals stay largely flat for the foreseeable future, you know, from a more bird's eye view, I do believe that we are in the midst of a longer term precious metals bull market here, whether that started in, you know, late 2015, early 2016 or spring of 2019, I think is up for debate. but I'm still viewing this, you know, firmly as a correction within a broader bull market. You know, and I will say sentiment has been abysmal. It's, you know, improved somewhat in recent days and weeks, but it's been absolutely abysmal for the PM patch. So as a contrarian investor, that gets me a bit more excited about adding to our higher conviction positions. And then really quickly, Corey, you mentioned silver. I do find silver quite interesting. I think investors need to be very careful with how they obtain exposure. You know, absolutely stick to quality names, quality management teams. There are a lot of silver companies where their, you know, the most important merit is that they have silver in their corporate title. So you don't want to go out and buy a broad basket. You want to be very selective with your picks. You know, that said, going back 50 years to the beginning of the 1970s, we actually haven't seen a period where gold has reached an all-time high and silver has not followed within the next 2.5 or 3 years. Sometimes silver follows immediately to an all-time high. Sometimes there's a 2.5 or 3 year lag. But we've not seen that not occur since 1970. Now, of course, this isn't an immutable law of nature. This time could be different. But if recent history repeats, that means we could be seeing $50 silver, you know, 3 years, we'll say, after the August 2020 all-time peak in gold there. So that would return, you know, 120% or so from current levels. And obviously those that have, you know, selected quality silver equities could do even better. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a rabid silver bull, but I think it's an interesting time to be looking at that metal as well.
Yeah, Matt, it is interesting that silver has been lagging gold and being able to break out to a new all-time high, but it does usually play catch up. And if history is any lesson, then we should see some outperformance in both silver and the silver stocks. A question for you, though, you'd brought up the new kind of environment we're in where so many retail investors are interested in the tech and the cryptos and the NFTs and the vaccine stocks. There was a lot of biotech stocks that surged. So there's this appetite for risk on that you were mentioning. And you said that if there was eventually a risk off environment, don't you think that more investors would probably rotate into gold first before they found the mining sector? Or do you think some of these miners, like the producers that are finally starting to produce good revenues and cash flows, and maybe we'll see a little more M&A, could that be a driver that gets some of that hot money looking at the mining stocks again? Or do you think that the sector has fundamentally changed from where it was maybe a decade or two ago, where maybe there's just less interest in the mining stocks in general because of all these other outlets for speculative fervor?
So I will say, I think as an investor, you have to prepare to get punched in the face in the immediate aftermath of a trend reversal there. So just like we saw in March 2020, precious metal stocks, I mean, just look at the GDX and GDXJ there. There were a couple weeks of absolute mayhem, got absolutely destroyed before we went on this, you know, 6 month rip-roaring rally. So, you know, I would assume that process does repeat itself. You know, you could argue that because of the strength in balance sheets of some of these production stage names. I mean, yeah, the gold space as a whole is in pretty doggone good shape here. You know, given that we've been between $2,100, I mean, even $1,800 an ounce is a pretty solid price for some of these higher quality production stage names. So, yes, I think it would play out like it generally does. You get hit first. Then folks start trickling into the larger, more liquid names, you know, more of the blue chips within the gold space, and then they start going, you know, further upstream to the development stage names, and then down to expiration, and then silver getting thrown in there as well. But you know, as an investor, this doesn't, you know, have to play out in exactly this manner, and you know, I think. Rather than trying to time the market perfectly, it makes more sense to accumulate names, you know, set some stink bids and see what you can pick up in these coming months.
So Matt, in terms of the most important factors you think to be watching for these companies, look, you're not alone in the sense of it might take some time for maybe a true up leg and a strong bull market up move again to take shape. But looking at companies, what we keep hearing is management. Obviously, that's important. Find management that has had past success. We're also hearing a lot about the importance of having cash in the bank for these companies because, look, a lot of money was raised about a year and a half ago, but there's a lot less being raised right now. Some companies are still raising money, but broadly, there are a few more of the, let's say, lower quality companies coming back to market and not being able to raise money. Is that a key distinction right now, that a company has money to continue working, but also has some extra funds to, let's say, last them at least 2 years, including their work programs?
Yeah, I think that's a key point there, Corey. You know, 2 years is maybe a little bit aggressive, but certainly a year. And I think for names where it becomes obvious to the market that they're going to have to finance in the next 6 to 9 months, you're going to have what's commonly called a financing overhang, where folks, even if they like the story, will instead sit on their hands, wait on the sidelines, and wait for the deal to be announced, you know, hoping to get a discount to market, you know, and or a half warrant or full warrant sweetener along with the deal. You know, I will say, in terms of the industry as a whole, I think there is an allocation issue. And to me, it's pretty striking. I was just looking at Austex Resources, which is Rob Murdoch's newsletter out of Australia, focused specifically on the ASX. And at the moment, just under 40% of ASX-listed resource companies are focused on gold. And the numbers in North America are similar. Last time I checked, it was actually a little bit north of 40% in North America. And so, you know, the junior industry as a whole, we have, you know, 40% plus of juniors focused on gold. You add in silver, you know, we're approaching 50% of all juniors are focused on precious metals. And if you look at the value of gold that's actually pulled out of the ground relative to the rest of the metal space, you know, in a given year, we're only talking 15 to 20% of the value there. So I actually think there's a bit of an allocation issue in the industry as a whole. There's, of course, a certain allure to gold, and I understand that. But I think this just goes to show that you have to be that much more specific, that much more selective with your gold investments. Really take a sniper-like approach. And for MJG, except in very, very rare circumstances, we always want to invest in, you know, assuming good management, good company structure, upcoming catalysts. From a project perspective, we always want to invest in projects where we think value can be created, even if the gold price or, say, the silver price stays flat for the next 3, 4, or 5 years. There are quite a few gold optionality plays out there where you're looking at large CapEx, low grade, low margin projects that have no chance of being built at, you know, $1,700, $1,800 gold, but could absolutely light up a spreadsheet at, you know, $3,000 plus gold. I don't think that's the way to play the space, because there's just so many of these vehicles out there that even when we do get that big move in gold, there's a lot of different mouths to feed. So I think that goes back to your point, Corey. Be very selective, you know, with the companies that you're looking at, and make sure they check all the boxes. As I mentioned, people, project, company structure, healthy working capital for a year plus, and hopefully two, as you said, and catalysts in the calendar to drive value, even if we don't see an immediate move in the metal price.
Well, Matt, some great points there and some good tips for investors. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. And you mentioned the allocation mismatch. So obviously there's more to the world and resources than just gold and silver. So let's talk about some of the other markets. One that's really has been lighting up the boards lately is the uranium sector. And some of that is on the back of the news of the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust going in and buying up with their at-the-market fundings and buying up uranium out of the spot market. But a lot of the miners have been honestly moving for the last year and a half, way before that. Some of that on the Strategic Reserves United States narrative. Some of that was on the front-running of the eventual contracting cycle starting up again. But what we've actually seen over the last year and a half is huge runs in the uranium stocks. And it didn't really matter whether they were quality companies or whether they had a wing and a prayer of getting into production in this cycle. Almost the whole sector has run up. So my question, Matt, is at this point, after the rally we've just seen really over the last month or two, another leg higher, do you think things are getting a little bit too frothy here? And in the uranium sector, is there an area that you like more than the other between the producers, the developers, the explorers? What do you make of this recent run higher in the uranium sector?
Sure. Well, as a metal, I really love uranium, actually. I mean, it's the only, it's the feed source to the only form of power aside from hydropower, but there's fewer and fewer rivers to dam these days, you know, putting aside environmental concern. But the only form of power that can operate 24/7 around the clock without any CO2 emissions. So I think, and especially with this decarbonization push that I think is to continue in the years and decades ahead, there's going to, of course, be some pushback as we go along the way, especially if it results in higher energy prices. But I think decarbonization is here to stay. I mean, uranium is absolutely a 21st century metal. And so I think if folks want to play the metal themselves, it could make a lot of sense to buy SPUT, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, or to buy Yellowcake, which is the, you know, London listed equivalent. In terms of the equities, though, I would be extremely cautious, particularly in this kind of frothy or even euphoric environment that you mentioned. Soon after Sprott finished its takeover of Uranium Participation Corp, we saw a rip-roaring rally in the uranium spot price, rising from the low 30s to quickly above 50. It's pulled back a little bit here, but now we're seeing kind of the animal spirits reemerge. So equities-wise, you know, as an investor, I think especially when we go to this risk-off period that we touched on previously in the interview, folks that are positioned in the more speculative names are at risk of absolutely getting killed, just due to the speculative premium that's built into a lot of these exploration and earlier stage development stage projects. So, you know, looking at uranium, I guess a few insights or potential tips for listeners. I at MJG, we're avoiding exploration entirely. The bar these days to an economic discovery in uranium is so incredibly high, not to mention the massive permitting weight that ensues after you make a discovery. But there's so many undeveloped pounds that are sitting in the ground, discovered and moving along the development curve, that from my perspective, focusing on uranium exploration is a losing game. And there will be the odd winner or two, but as a whole, that's a space that we're avoiding entirely. Second point here, and I alluded to it a little bit, but permits. Permitting in uranium and having an actual mining permit in hand is really more valuable than perhaps for any other metal. So if you're looking at a development stage name and it doesn't already have a permit in hand, or it's not expecting one imminently, from my perspective, it then makes sense to just go for the very best development stage project. So why not just go to NextGen at that point? If you don't have if your development stage project and you don't have a permit, then it's you're in a tough spot, and it can be years or even decades to get there. And so, you know, our large uranium position in the portfolio is permitted and ready to go. And there are a couple names out there that share that distinction. So I think that's something that investors are perhaps underweighting in this environment, when you have kind of unsophisticated non-mining folks charging into the space and buying really anything with uranium in the corporate title. And, you know, the third point, and this echoes some of my feedback from earlier in this interview, but it's to stay disciplined. I mean, again, this name that we own in the portfolio, and I've mentioned it publicly in previous interviews, it's Global Atomic, not a recommendation to your listeners, mind you. But that project works at spot uranium prices. You know, I think if you want to get a little bit greedy as you're plugging numbers into your spreadsheet, you can assume 50, 55, maybe $60 uranium. But I'd really urge folks not to go overboard and not assume uranium prices any higher than $60 per pound. I could be very wrong here. The supply lag as prices move higher could take longer than folks expect. And, you know, uranium does have that sex appeal. And we saw, you know, back in 2005, 2006, 2007, it can go on pretty tremendous runs. But from my perspective, it's better to be more conservative, assume no higher than $60 uranium for the foreseeable future. And if we're surprised to the upside, then great. But I don't think you want to get too greedy in this environment. And again, just to reiterate the first point, be aware that, you know, this is not a contrarian space at the moment. It simply isn't. And when the market turns and we go risk off, some of these more speculative names are going to fall, you know, 50% plus. So investors should keep that in mind.
Final quick comment regarding uranium sector. You even said maybe just focus on these de-risk projects, the ones that should either be moving into production or should be a near-term takeout target, because they are quite defined. NextGen being a great example of that. Matt, when do you think any of these takeovers are going to happen? Because in all fairness, we've seen more majors cutting supply than actually going out there and spending large amounts of money to bring on more supply.
Oh yeah, that is the $64,000 question, Corey, as they say. You know, I don't have any particular timetable on additional consolidation within the uranium space. I do think within the United States, there's one or two consolidators out there that are hoovering up plays. So kind of some of these smaller names, we might see consolidation. But in terms of the high quality projects, you know, whether it's NextGen's Arrow up in the Athabasca Basin or Global Atomic, as I mentioned, their DASA project in Niger. You know, I think there are suitors out there. When will both sides come to the table and make an agreement? I think that's anybody's guess. But I don't expect on the NextGen front, I don't expect the current management team to ultimately be taking that project into production. I might be proven wrong, but that's the assumption. On the DASA front, it's the reverse. I think there is a chance of a takeout before we see first production there. But my assumption is that the current management team is going to take the project into production, either on a standalone basis or probably more likely with a toll milling agreement with Orano to start.
Just one more quick one on uranium, Matt, and that is, you know, there's a big anticipation of the longer term contracting cycle starting with the utility companies. I think a lot of that could have been potentially priced in at this point. And like you're saying, most companies that are going to produce, whether they were a prior producer or a developer that's near term, and six or seven of them also bought uranium out of the spot markets themselves so that they could actually start this beginning contracting cycle. If they do come to the table, utility companies, and they, let's say it's 55 or 60 bucks, and they say, okay, we'll go ahead and do a 5 to 7 year agreement with you or longer, do you think that would cap the move up that we've seen and potentially cause a reversal at that point where the production's now coming online, the dozen or so companies that can produce will, and then all the remaining, you know, 40, 50 companies have maybe overdone it? Or do you think that actually would spur the next leg higher?
I think I would lean towards the former. I think the producers out there would be happy to contract large amounts of their uranium in the price ranges that you talked about. And, you know, names like Global Atomic make, you know, they're excellent returns at $55 or $60 uranium. You know, I do think we'll see contracting occur maybe a little sooner than it would have otherwise due to the price action and the spot markets that SPUT's entrance to the scene has provided. I think that's been a bit of a come to Jesus moment for some of these utilities. So yeah, stay tuned on that front.
All right, Matt, let's shift over one final market and one market that we have not talked about. Well, I don't know when the last time we talked about it was, but it's the phosphate market. You shared with us off mic that in, well, your recent MJG investor letter, you're showing a healthy weighting towards phosphate. Why now? Why phosphate? What attracts you there?
Good. Well, I love talking phosphate, but I will say, Corey, the reason we have a large weighting towards phosphate, I found an individual opportunity that I liked, really independent of the metal. You know, it was a development asset, stage asset that I've known for nearly a decade. That was trading at 20 cents on the dollar to historical expenditures, and at over 95% discount to the project's NPV in past economic studies, and also to the, you know, valuation garnered in the last ag minerals cycle. So it's a severely discounted asset. With a management team that's very well incentivized, 20 plus percent insider ownership, actually closer to 30%, and a team that I've also known for quite some time. And then there's catalysts in the calendar and enough cash in the bank to get through those potential catalysts. So this had much more to do with the company specific bet than it did you know, anything to do with phosphate. That said, I do find phosphate to be quite an interesting mineral to be looking at the moment. You know, some of your listeners may be aware, it's one of the three key ingredients towards inorganic fertilizer. potash, which is also a bulk material similar to phosphate, being the second, and then nitrogen being the third. So these are essential for the inorganic fertilizer being used to fertilize our fields globally. Interestingly, from a geological perspective, phosphate is 10 times more rare in the Earth's crust than potash. And additionally, it's much less geographically diversified than potash. In fact, 75% of known phosphate reserves globally sit within Morocco, which is pretty insane when you think about it. I mean, Saudi Arabia is known as the king of oil, and current numbers have them at around 70% of global oil reserves. So we're talking, you know, significantly more from more of a dependence on Morocco, and even more so, a good amount of this phosphate that sits within Morocco is actually within Western Sahara, which is a contested territory. In recent months, there's been live firefights between, you know, rebel groups in the area that think they should have autonomy, and the Moroccan military. And, you know, there's potential there for supply disruptions, you know, if the world or the UN or some of these NGOs start pushing that angle farther. So, again, very much reliant on Morocco for a source of supply. You know, it's been a good, and you mentioned this, we haven't, there's been very little chatter about ag minerals here, really for the past 13 or 14 years. You know, the last big ag mineral boom occurred in the late stages of, you know, the 2002 to 2007 China-driven commodity bull market. And there's been very little speculation and very little investment in exploration and development for either of these bulk materials in the years since. And, you know, I will say, and again, history does not have to repeat itself, but usually once, you know, per every proper commodity bull market, you do see these ag minerals catch investors' attention. And the narrative itself can actually be very intoxicating. I mean, at the end of the day, we do have to eat. And I think folks are already starting to recognize that global food prices have been moving higher in really a V-shaped fashion, you know, really since the aftermath of the March 2020 COVID bust. And, you know, this is kind of the next logical place for speculators to potentially go here. And I'll add finally, you know, there are very few phosphate juniors out there in North America. There's just a handful of them. And this tells us a couple things. I mean, the first is that if/when there are major capital flows back into this space, it could lead to some pretty significant moves. Because, you know, unlike the gold space, where 40% of juniors out there are focused on the metal, there's just so few speculative vehicles at the moment. And I think it also just tells you generally that we're in the earlier stages of this ag mineral cycle. And, you know, when we start to see a new potash or new phosphate junior minted out of Vancouver every you know, month or every few weeks, that probably tells us that we're closer to the time to take profits, if not at the time to take profits. But that's simply not the case right now. So, you know, again, I would not encourage any investor out there to buy a basket of juniors to speculate in a specific commodity. I think it has to make sense on a company specific basis. You know, that said, I think there is a tailwind to the ag minerals generally and phosphate specifically, and there's not been a lot of chatter about it recently. However, that may change. Just a couple weeks ago, it was confirmed that the Chinese government had ordered all state-owned phosphate producers and other phosphate, privately owned phosphate producers in country to freeze all exports outside of China, which is an interesting development, through mid-2022. So that's going to apply pressure on phosphate pricing, you know, might bring some eyes over to the space. And then the next big question is, you know, what happens in summer of 2022? Does this export ban continue, or do we see exports resume? So that's something for folks to watch.
Well, Matt, just one more quick comment on the fertilizer space. You know, for a while, we saw a lot of speculation in the potash names, and there was another wave of it maybe a few years back, and then it all filtered out because there was just too much supply coming online, and there was too much capex needed to bring on some of the larger projects. You've outlined the case brilliantly for the phosphate advantage, but do you still see any potential room for some of those potash companies to come back on people's radars as we're seeing inflation in the marketplace, as we're seeing food costs go up, and obviously with more mouths to feed in the world, we're going to need fertilizer? Do you think that there's room for some of the potash names to move as well?
Potentially. There's more of them out there, though, than the phosphate names, kind of an order of magnitude more. And I also, at least through MJG, we also have exposure to potash already through Altius Minerals. So in my mind, that's currently the best way to play potash if you want to do so. Altius is obviously very well diversified across really the commodity spectrum, sands, precious metals. They even have a little bit of precious metals exposure, but they focus outside of there. But I think if you subtract out the value of the company's Labrador iron ore holdings, their prospect generation portfolio, their Altius renewable royalty shares, and their net cash position, you're left with a pretty small enterprise value relative to an incredible royalty portfolio. And I mean, you can ask Brian Dalton, the company's CEO himself, if he could only keep one of his royalties and had to sell the rest of them, it would be the Saskatchewan based potash royalties covering Nutrien and Mosaic mines that he would hold on to. So I think not the majority, but close to the majority of the company's royalty portfolio, or at least the net asset value of that royalty portfolio, can be reasonably attributed to these potash assets, excuse me. And from a portfolio construction perspective, because we already have that exposure and, you know, have the potential to increase our positioning in Altius further, I'm a little less interested in the junior potash angle at the moment.
All right, Matt, great having you on the show, buddy. Really appreciate you taking the first two segments and sharing your thoughts on the precious metals and also some of the other sectors that one you're avoiding and the other that you have gone into thanks to an attractive company. Always great chatting with you, Matt, and we will be having you back on in about a month's time. In the meantime, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And hey, Matt, again, thanks for all your insights.
Thanks, Corey. Thanks, Dad.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments, really focused on resources and investing in the resource sector. We are going to switch to a bit more broad topics in this segment as we are chatting with Axel Merk, President and Chief Investment Officer over at Merk Investments. Now, Axel, I go to you regularly for a lot of comments on a wide range of markets, but also a lot focused on currencies. And that's where I want to start here with, especially the US dollar. It's been a real up and down year to date so far for the dollar. The US dollar on the dollar index started off the year in the low 89 region, ran up through the tail end of March up to about 93.50, and then dropped really quickly back down to that 89 region, and has since that time in, let's say, June, continued to trend higher and most recently touched a high of right around 94.50. Now, tail end of this week, we have seen the dollar pull back as we're recording this, more around that 94 region. Axel, give us your general thoughts on where you see the dollar going from here and what you think the key catalysts are driving the dollar forward, please.
Well, great to be with you. Well, in the short term, it's speculators. And as we're talking, we don't have the most recent report available from this week yet, but the speculative positions on the long side were very high. And I think that is part of the reason why the dollar made it over 94. On the broader scope of things, I am in the reflationary camp. Now, obviously, reflation hasn't worked so great because lots of countries are sputtering, supply chains are disrupted and whatnot. But people are trying to reflate. And as they will eventually succeed with that, it means that the rest of the world that's gradually opening up will borrow U.S. dollars to what that's what it is when they take out loans, dollar-denominated notes, which is a short on the dollar. And so as the deflation is stepping in, that means the dollar should weaken over time. Now, obviously, that also makes it more vulnerable to these risk-off environments. When the risk asset, meaning the S&P 500, drops down, then there might be a flight to the dollar as people delever. They have to reduce then those dollar shorts. So for the time being, the speculators drove up the dollar. But I do think the dollar will weaken in the medium term.
Yeah, Axel, I was going to ask you about that. It's a strange environment to see inflation in a lot of the commodities and agricultural products, in a lot of household appliances, and also in wages. And that's all kind of pushing the reflation-inflation narrative. But at the same time, there are those market skitters and jitters about the Fed tapering and what that will mean. And there's some projections of a slowdown in growth and GDP moving forward. So you would think that that we would have a weaker dollar with all this inflation, but instead we've seen a flight to safety in the dollar, which has pushed it higher. Could we actually be entering that stagflationary period similar to the 70s? We see a lot of articles out that on that topic where we have slowing growth with inflation. Could that be why things have been in this weird limbo?
Well, sure, but let me first make a comment on higher inflation. Historically, when inflation picks up, the currency of a country often strengthens. And that may sound odd, but that happens because the market believes that dear central bankers are going to do the right thing and hike rates prudently so that no inflation is going to be a problem in the long term. It's that only after a while that people realize, oh my God, these guys are not serious about being tough, that then the currency weakens. And so that's why in the short term, you have these confusing signals. Now, you're referring to stagflation. Well, stagflation happens in an environment where, for example, commodity prices are high, but you cannot have actual real good growth. And that's exactly what happens when you shut down part of the economy and then trying with full throttle to move things forward. And the headwinds, like one of the reasons why we have a headwind is because people bought all the gadgets they possibly could during the pandemic, and so they have overconsumed in some ways. Some of the fiscal stimulus is abating. The unemployment benefits are running out. On the infrastructure bill and so forth, I expect that to be somewhat neutral. It's not going to be as grand as the Democrats had hoped, but it's not going to be the same sort of drag we had in 2008. I think the key thing here to remember is this environment is different from 2008 or post-2008, both on the supply and the demand side. On the demand side, you don't have the fiscal drag, and on the supply side, we're throttling things down. So it's a very different environment, and the inflationary pressures can unfold in that. And yes, stagflation is a real risk, and you see that by people, including us now, with more talking about it.
So some of the short-term moves, too, in the dollar, going back to September, the dollar moved up for pretty much five straight weeks. And this week, again, we haven't closed the markets, but the dollar looks to be closing flat, potentially down. So that run could end. A lot of that run, though, could be predicated on at least the Fed talking a bit more dovishly. Again, they haven't started to unwind the QE program. They haven't gone through any rate hikes, but the market is starting to price in some rate hikes and a general unwind. That could very well be what pushed the dollar. What do you think about the Fed's policy moving forward here, Axel? Are we going to get an unwind? Are we going to get a rate hike? I know the rate hike's a year plus out, but how critical is that to assess and understand?
Well, a few things. First, the Fed has been very consistent in saying they want to finish the taper next summer. Everybody is saying, oh, are they going to stop tapering now, next month, a month later? Well, if they want to finish it next summer, they better get going with it. And historically, the Fed is always, not always, but usually slower than the market is pricing in. And so after the financial crisis, it took years before we went off the zero ground. Now, you and I may think, well, it's about time. I mean, it's one thing to be tightening. It's another to go into neutral. The Fed has all but promised not to even to go into neutral, but to stay just about full throttle until we have this so-called maximum employment. And maximum employment has been morphing into getting just about everybody off the sidelines. And so if they stick to that, then no, they're not going to hike. But if at the same time this transitory thing is suddenly not so transitory anymore in the eyes of the Fed, then of course they can act sooner. But keep in mind that part of the reason the Fed is doing this walkway saying, hey, we're not going to do anything, is they don't want the taper tantrum. And if they say, hey, we're going to hike early, then they're going to get a taper tantrum because it means the bond market will reprice things. If the bond market reprices things, all hell can break loose in other markets. And Powell is petrified about that. And so I think we're going to get a little more talk. Oh, my God, yeah, maybe inflation lasts a little bit longer, but trust us, everything will be fine. And so they're not going to hike rates. Now, obviously, there's a chance that Powell is not going to be Fed chair anymore come early next year. But any replacement that's in consideration, I don't think is going to have a dramatically different policy either.
What about other central banks too? You paying attention to any of their comments? And quite frankly, some of the smaller central banks have started going through unwind and even rate hikes. Do you think that plays any role in the markets or in currencies?
Well, yeah, as we talk, Singapore just hiked rates. So that was refreshing. So we do have, and then in Southeast Asia, some are considering to hike rates. There's talk about the UK hiking rates. Well, the good news is we're going to have a greater dispersion. And that makes market. When everybody's at zero, and it's very, very difficult to discern of, I mean, we can say, oh, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys. But no, having some differentiation is going to be very, very healthy to allow also to for capital to be allocated more according to some things that might make more sense. If everybody just goes full throttle, putting foam on the street so that everything is well greased, that's a very unhealthy environment we've had for a long time. And so, yes, the big boys, they don't want to do much, but some of the smaller players are starting to say, yes, we will hike. Now, that said, also as we speak, the Bank of Japan has come out, hey, all these guys talk about tapering and maybe hiking, that's not us. So Japan, and by the way, the yen being obviously one of the weaker currencies, as they're glued to the zero bound here, Japan is not likely going to be one of those that's going to start hiking. But I'm not telling you anything you don't know, I don't think.
Well, Axel, just shifting over from the currencies and the fiat money over to sound money and hard money, the precious metals, one would have thought that the precious metals would have fared a little bit better considering all the reports coming back on the rising inflation. But then again, it did have a big run in 2019, 2020, up to its all-time high of 2089, and then gold has pulled back for the last year and a half. We've seen a little bounce recently and a little bit of divergence from the general markets over the last couple of weeks. Do you think this recent bounce is the beginning of a new uptrend, or what would it take to get a more sustained rally in the precious metals?
Well, we look at the price of gold relative to real interest rates, but not looking so much at the current CPI, but more what's priced in 10-year rates, the TIPS yield, the inflation-protected securities yield, for example. And that's, as we speak, at about minus 1%. It was as low as minus 1.2%. So it has come up in recent months a little bit, and that may well have been part of the reason why the price of gold was kind of more range-bound. And as you point out, it had a major run-up last year. And now it really depends on what one thinks about what's going to happen to inflation. It's going to get more ingrained and how our thing's going to react to it. If the Fed sticks to its guns and it's not going to do much, I think economic activity is going to increase, inflationary pressures are going to persist, and that's a very fertile environment for the price of gold. Now, but it's ultimately a question of where investors think that real interest rates are going to be heading in. And the other investors, by the way, we historically see when we look at the folks we see investing in gold, are those that invest because of the diversification benefits of gold. And there, the correlation that in the long run to the S&P is near zero, but in recent months has been elevated. That's actually in recent weeks has been declining. And so we might see more of those diversification investors come in. And then there are the short-term speculators that love to jump on a trend. And we haven't seen many of those. They tend to be more into the meme stocks right now. But overall, to me, it's about the risk of things happening in the markets, and that's the risk of the Fed not being on the ball, I think, is sufficiently high that I continue to like gold here.
Yeah, the Fed is inherently behind the curve. That's where the statement comes from. I just wanted to follow up on something you just mentioned, though, Axel, and that was when you're talking about real rates, a lot of people will use the tips and, you know, take that away, as the inflationary component and take that away from the 10-year. But there's also a lot of people that use the CPI. And when you look at those two things, there's a big disparity because the Fed has a heavy hand on the tips rates and they massage about 25% of that market. And it gives you a negative one reading. But if you look at the CPI numbers we get and then look at the 10-year, we're actually at negative four. So how do you balance out those two differing views of just how bad inflation is and just how negative the real rates are?
Well, ever since 2008 at the latest, the Fed has really taken away its means of getting feedback from the market by, as you point out, being so actively engaged in the market. When the Fed is buying all these securities, well, then you cannot read what the market says. I think that's very unhealthy. But it's kind of the best we get. There are various other inflation measures, but partially because of that Fed interference, they may also be distorted. All that said, the markets are forward-looking. And so it doesn't really matter what happened yesterday or today. It matters what will happen in due course. And so you pick your poison as to how you want to look at it. I reference the tips yield as an easy proxy. But no matter what you use, right, it's the relative movements that are really the ones that we like to look at. Are things getting better or worse with regard to real interest rates? And for that, even those distorted metrics are still of some use. And so it's that. And then part of it is, of course, yes, where do you think that the folks at the Fed are going to do things? Because one argument is, say, the 10-year yield is really a reflection of the next 10 years of what the Federal Reserve is going to do. And so there, it's obviously a lot of qualitative assessment of who you think is going to govern there. But it looks like the next 2.5 years or so, it's certainly going to be the same president, at least the same party that's going to dictate who the next Fed chair is going to be. And so that, I think, sets the tone, and trying to predict that much further out, I don't know. And the other way to look at it is, of course, what are the incentives in the system? And since we've told the fiscal authorities that they can spend whatever they want and it doesn't matter, and yet you have an incentive to debase the currency when you have too much debt, I don't think there's going to be too much change here. So yes, as imperfect as many of these market measures are these days, I think they do tell a similar story.
So Axel, I want to look at the metals sector, commodities broadly here, because look, it has been encouraging this week for the precious metals bugs that gold has recovered to right around 1800. Silver's back in its range and let's say 2350 as we are recording right now. But quite frankly, gold's been trading in that 1800 range really back to June, and silver's been in this about $8 range for about a year now. We look to some of the other metals, though, looking at base metals, and I'll use copper as an example here. Copper is up over 12% in 2 weeks. Oil is up at 7-year highs. So we are seeing more of these economic or more economy-based metals moving stronger. Oil, copper, base metals broadly, precious metals still stuck in the range. What's your takeaway from this environment here?
Well, that it's a mess. That's the short answer. Now, every commodity is a little different. I certainly don't encourage anybody to trade it unless you really know what you're doing. If you look at crude, spot prices and the next delivery month is expensive, but if you go out a year, it gets cheaper, and so that suggests that the frackers will come online. If you look at some of the agricultural commodities, they're completely haywire. Some of it driven by the tariffs that the Chinese are buying stuff in the U.S. because the U.S. is refusing to buy things that are produced that potentially come from the wrong regions in China. Supply bottlenecks are everywhere, and on the metals, and then obviously not just on these ones, but on various ones out there. And so this is all a symptom of the times that we live in. It means that if you invest in these markets, you better have a strong stomach, or you know what you're doing. Part of the reason I like gold is much simpler, right? There's much less industrial use. But I just structured CoinDeal an hour or two ago, and there's, again, tightness in various coins. Right? There are supply chain issues everywhere. And so that usually means volatility is coming up. And by the way, the best thing against high prices is, as some people are pointing out, high prices. And so when a particular commodity is very expensive, then people will start looking for substitutes. But yeah, it's a mess out there. And then, by the way, just on the, to continue rambling here, if you look at the U.S. at the ports, there are not enough truck drivers in some places to get things down. In the U.K., the ships are deciding not to, to dock there because there are not enough lorry drivers, truck drivers there, right? And so things are... there isn't enough labor around to move these goods, and people are looking for a plan B. And somebody pointed out to me they got a Halloween tree. Apparently, some Christmas tree shipper was early because they were so afraid, and then they dumped it in the store. And so for Halloween, it puts a Christmas tree up there with some spooky things. So it's, everything is a bit messed up right now.
I guess that's where we can wrap it up, is that, yes, everything is a bit messed up right there. And maybe in these markets too, it's not the time to be getting too aggressive because there are so many cross currents. And look, these markets are telling us Q4 is going to go down as one of the more volatile markets broadly than we have had over the last about 5 or 6 quarters. So let's get through this quarter and see maybe what trends start to develop in 2022. Axel, always great chatting with you, buddy. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend show. Again, Axel Merck, President and CIO, Merck Investments. Axel, have a great rest of your weekend.
My pleasure. You too.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. And I'm happy to report that in this final segment, I am chatting with Richard Postma, aka Doc. Now, Doc, I've been having you on more sporadically recently because we really do like to focus on the longer term charts, especially for the precious metals. And quite frankly, the longer term charts haven't been showing all that much change, unfortunately. We continue to see precious metals broadly being under some pressure here, but this last week was encouraging for the gold and silver bugs because we did get a bounce, and even in the stocks, a bounce from some pretty close breakdown levels. We're going to focus on the technicals here, and we're going to start with gold. I know you like looking at the longer term monthly chart here, Doc, so let's look at this chart. Gold this week recovered to just short of 1800. Pulled back a little bit at the end of the week, but still going to put in a positive week. And at least right now, still positive for the month of October. What's your takeaway from this recent bounce here, Doc? Any encouragement for the upside for the gold bugs?
Corey, last week on your site, I mentioned that I thought that this week we might see a pop in gold and in these stocks. And we did, as we're seeing. And now we've had a little pullback. But I think the rest of October is going to be okay. I think we might move down a little bit here again, but I think we move back up and we're going to challenge that 20-month moving average on the Bollinger Bands that I've been talking about. And I mentioned that if we close before that, that puts us at greater risk for a longer period of time. Well, we're right at it, and I wouldn't be surprised if we move back up over it over before the end of the month, and whether we close above it, on it, or below it. We'll have to wait and see, but I think the rest of this month is not going to be bad for gold. And I think today's actions of the stocks are probably telling you that, because we had a good sell-off today and the stocks didn't get hit that hard today. So that's a good sign, but I feel it's only a short-term move, Corey. And I think November could be a little problematic, but we'll see. But this month, I don't have a problem with this month.
Okay. And just to recap, we are recording this about halfway, a little more than halfway through the trading day on Friday. Gold is down on the futures about $30, a little over 1.5%. GDX, GDXJ, those are down, but not even quite a full percent. So yes, the stocks are weathering this sell down a little bit better. Doc, big picture though, you've been talking about this U-shaped recovery really ever since we started chatting now, man, years ago, probably 6 or 7 years ago. This U-shaped recovery did formulate here, about 2011, 2012, that was the top. And then we also had this other top that almost perfectly completed this U-shaped recovery in 2020 when gold reached just short of 2100. But now we're pulling back. The question being, was that the end of the run? Is this now turning into a bear market, or is this turning into just a long-term cup and handle formation that could lead to higher prices?
Well, one could say, Corey, that this move we had up in the gold market in 2019 and 20 could have been a bull trap. It turned up over the closing highs of 2011, 2012, barely, and now we're moving back down. And so it could have been just a bull trap in a bear market, which I think we're going to be in here for a little while yet. But the handle is still in place, and I think it's a very good possibility yet, because I think for the rest of the year, we're, of course, not going to go up and challenge those highs that we saw in 2020. And in 2022, we may form the bottom of that handle, and then the earliest that we could see a move up for that handle on the right side of that handle probably could be 2023.
Yeah, with a cup and handle formation, we do need to remember the cup took about 9+ years to form. So the handle, it's reasonable to assume it takes maybe about a third of that time. So that is 2 to 3 years out. Doc, when it comes to levels on this monthly chart, you outlined that 20-month moving average. That's sitting at about 1809. Is that the higher level you think we could get to? You said that we could take that out this month. And on the downside, does it just continue to be that 1675 level is critical?
Yeah, 1675 is pretty critical. What bothers me about the monthly chart right now, if you look, there's a little nuance on the MACD. And the 26-month moving average on the MACD has developed a little hook down. And now we're in the 12-month, it has moved toward that a little bit. Well, it's very similar to what happened back in April, where it got close to it, and then it began its descent again. I wouldn't be surprised if we see the same thing in November. And that concerns me a little bit. And if we do, we can start moving back towards 1700 again.
Now, Doc, what about the stocks? Because you look at something like GDX and GDXJ at the end of last month, it was, you could argue, almost dire for those stocks because they had dropped below what was pretty strong support at around that 30 level. I'm looking at GDX right here. GDX went the whole way down to about 28.83. So it did break that level. It closed the month near a low. It was looking pretty bad, but the stocks have rebounded this month, taking them out of that breakdown level. What do you see in that GDX chart?
What I see is that we're still have a tendency to move down. And when you look at the MACD, it looks like November we might move back down to challenge that low of this month. But the encouraging sign is the lower Bollinger bands on the monthly chart are starting to flatten out, and that's good because if we can move back down and then hang around, we might have seen the lows in GDX. So that's what I hope, but we have more work yet. As long as we hold that lower Bollinger band on the monthly chart, the longer we hold above that, the more likely that we're not going to go much lower. And there's odds that we won't take out 25 on GDX. So that's good, but we still have more work to do, and it's going to be a little hairy as we move toward the end of the year and into the first part of next year.
So, Doc, when we look big picture at this chart, one thing that has me a little concerned is the fact that you look where GDX was pre-pandemic. So the level it got to in February of 2020 made a high of 3167, which is pretty much right where GDX is trading right now, except very different in the sense that GDX was trending up ever since 2018. So about a year and a half, had a nice upward trend. The pandemic hit, big washout, and then that big spike higher. But now GDX has been trending down for over a year. And again, it's right back to those pandemic levels. I realize gold is higher, silver slightly higher as well than where they were pre-pandemic, but the stocks are telling us maybe a little bit of a concerning story. What would you say to that? And how do you relate that GDX is trading where it was back pre-pandemic?
Yeah, it's really tough on some folks because a lot of people were 100% at the August highs in 2020 and hopeful that we're going to continue higher, and especially with the perspective of inflation. And here we have inflation hitting us between the eyes, but yet gold does not seem to be impressed by it yet. I think down the road it could be, but that's worrisome because, of course, these markets look forward. And is gold possibly telling us that we're going to have a slowdown in this economy and maybe a slowdown in the increasing rate of inflation? Who knows? But gold has not been that impressed with the inflation increases that we're seeing. But as you mentioned, it's back down to where it was when it first started pre-pandemic. But it's going to be great opportunities for the people going forward because, as I mentioned before, a lot of these stocks and some have actually taken out, they're double bottoming, or some of them haven't quite double bottomed, some have double bottomed, some have actually taken out that March low back in 2020. So there are real opportunities coming up, and in fact, I bought a little bit more than usual earlier this week. I didn't just nibble, I more than nimbled. And I want to say that that doesn't mean I'm going all in, folks, not at all, because I think we're going to be able to get even better prices on some of these stocks. And I'm waiting for that as we move toward 2022.
So, Doug, what are you buying? Care to share any of the stocks or at least the stage that these companies are in terms of exploration, development, production? What do you like out there then?
I added quite a bit today and earlier this week on some exploration plays that are just have been crushed. And I don't see a lot of downside anymore to them. And so if I buy them, they're not going to really hurt me if we continue to see downturn in this gold market. Eventually, as we move toward the end of the year and into next year, I'm going to get much more aggressive on some of the producers because I think they'll be the first ones out of the gate when we do get the significant next move up. But right now I'm monkeying around with some of the exploration plays and some of the mid tiers, but I'm waiting for some of these bigger companies to get hit a little bit more. And then I'll take a bigger position in some of them. I already have positions in some of them, but I'll add to them.
Can you give us any names, Doc? Everybody wants company names. Please share a couple with us.
Well, of course, one of my favorite is Equinox because they're going to be increasing their production over the next 2 years. And I really like that when I see that in companies. And so that's one of them I'm going to add quite a bit to it. It's had a nice little run here, but I don't like to buy them after they've had a run. I'll wait for it to get back to the lower Bollinger band on the monthly chart. I like Sandstorm. I want to add to that one eventually. I bought some Nova Resources. I bought a little Brixton Revival Gold. I bought a number of stocks earlier this week. I'm looking at buying a little bit more Lion One coming up. And Fosterville South is another one I added to this week. They've all moved down really nicely. And that's what I'm going to nibble at more as we go forward. But the main producer I like, I also like Argonaut a lot. But Argonaut and Equinox are a couple of the ones I really want to take bigger positions in going forward.
Okay, number of stocks there. Thank you for sharing all that, Doc. And you know what? We're going to wrap it up here, but we're going to try to chat in the next couple of weeks, and we'll cover a couple of the other metals charts as well as maybe some other broad market charts as well. But really just wanted to focus here on gold and some of the stocks that you are buying. Doc, I really appreciate you taking some time sharing your thoughts on these markets. Everybody, thank you for tuning in throughout this week, and thanks for sticking with us as we launch the new website. We are still tinkering with it. Please be sure to come visit our website, listen to the editorials we recorded throughout the week, especially those company updates, and please let us know if you want to see any other companies on the show, or if you have any questions for those companies and any other suggestions you have for our new website. We are still tinkering with it. Doc, everybody else, thank you again for tuning in, and I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.